We would like to take a moment to thank our sponsor, Preborn. When a mother meets her baby on an ultrasound and hears their heartbeat, it's a divine connection, and the majority of the time, she will choose life. But she can't do it without our help. Preborn needs us, the pro-life community, to come alongside her. One ultrasound is just $28. To donate, dial #250 and say the keyword baby, or visit preborn.com.
Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
I love talking about the things of God because of truth and the biblical worldview. The U.S. Constitution obligates our government to preserve and protect the rights that our founders recognize come from God, our Creator, not our government. I believe that Scripture in the Bible is very clear that God is the one that raised up each of you, and God has allowed us to be brought here to this specific moment in time.
This is Jenna Ellis in the Morning.
Good morning. Good morning. It is Thursday, August 15th, and if my voice sounds a little bit lower than usual, it is not your radio. It is not your ears. It is because I'm almost losing my voice, which is not great for the radio business, but that's okay since we have some guests this morning who will probably, hopefully, talk more than me today. So let's get to the headline. This story coming out of the UK is a cautionary tale for where America is headed. A 60-year-old Brit gets 18 months in prison for chanting a vulgarity about Allah. So this, of course, is geared toward Muslims, which have pretty much it's up about 10% in the population of the United Kingdom. And this is basically a blasphemy law that is being enforced because the chant apparently is against the rules over in the UK. So the sentence was handed out, and it is the latest shocking example of how low the bar has now been set in terms of free speech in a response to this man who was protesting in the UK. So let's bring on our first guest, Mike Donnelly, who is an attorney and a law professor. And Mike, take it away.
Hey, good morning, Jenna. It's great to be with you, and sorry to hear you're under the weather. Hope you get better soon. Great to talk with you and your audience. And yeah, this is an interesting story, and people need to understand that the European view on free speech is very different from our view here in the United States, and I would say our view is way better. We actually believe that people should have the right to express themselves, and even if we disagree with what they have to say, they have a right to say it, as long as they're not inciting violence, right? That's kind of the line that we have here in the United States, that if you're actually inciting violence or people to take violent action, then you cross over a line of free speech into, you know, action and violent action, which, you know, is subject to criminal sanction. Now, this older gentleman in the UK, this is a case from about a year ago, actually, and the sentence just got handed down. And he was prosecuted for disorderly conduct. And I've been trying to find the case. It's hard to find, so all you see is these headlines, and there's some basic information about this case, but he was prosecuted for disorderly conduct. Now, I've seen some of the video, and I've read some of the stories. It doesn't really sound like to me that he deserves 18 months in jail for what he did. That's my view. But it's interesting that this comes out at a time when you have protests getting quite violent in the UK in response to that stabbing incident that occurred tragically at the end of July, where three young girls were killed by a 17-year-old of Rwandan descent who apparently was born in the UK. Originally, people thought it was he was an immigrant or a migrant of some kind. But that has sparked incredible protests all over the country over the number of illegal aliens and people coming from other parts of the world to the UK, where the UK government is allowing them in, kind of like what our government has been doing for the last 4 years. But point being, free speech, we've got it here in the United States. In the UK and in England, it's a little bit different. But what's been happening in the UK in response to these protests that are a reaction to what happened in the end of July is you've got people who are doing similar things, and they're getting sentenced to even more. You've got people who've been sentenced to 2 years. About 70 to 100 people have been sentenced to prison for participating in some of these protests. Some of them probably deserve some jail time. A lot of them probably don't because of you know, being arrested just because they're saying things. And the other thing about the UK is they actually have a hate crimes law, where if you commit a crime and you're allegedly doing it because of a you're causing a person to perceive that you are hostile to their race, religion, and yes, they have sexual orientation, and even explicitly call out transgender status in the UK as a way that you can prosecute people for hate crimes. So this is something that we need to be paying attention to here in the United States.
Yeah, and I'm speaking with Mike Donnelly, who is an attorney and law professor. And Mike, you know, while we do have the First Amendment and protected free speech, I mean, I can see this going the way of the UK really soon. I mean, when you look at what the EU is trying to do to Elon Musk and censorship of X, and even what some of the leftist progressives are attempting to do, and the Marxists basically to say, if you're, the content of your speech isn't the propaganda that we prefer, then misinformation and disinformation can be criminally punished and at the very least censored. I mean, Tim Walz has been openly saying that. And so how much protection are we thinking that we're still going to get to not go the way of the UK here in the United States?
I mean, that's a really fair question. You know, it is very troubling to me when you have a person who wants to be the vice president of the United States and has said the things that Tim Walz has said. That's just unacceptable. But that is what the left wants to do. They've been trying to do it for a long time. They're trying to take over the speech, take over language. They want to either control your thinking by forcing you to use their words, like, you know, what pronouns you can use for people and that kind of thing. Or they want to control your speech by making you fearful that if you say something, you could be arrested and thrown in jail. That's a strategy that they have. I believe that we've got a very strong tradition here in the United States, both in the courts and in the law for free speech. But I am concerned about what I see about people's willingness to control people's speech or arrest people's speech. I mean, I get involved with some cases of street preachers who are arrested for preaching the gospel. And this was in the context of June's Pride Month, where, you know, pastors went out and street preachers went out to some of these events. And they held up signs and they tried to engage people in conversation to, you know, point them to scripture. And they were treated very poorly by the police. And so there is something of a trend of that. And that's troubling. You know, we need to work hard in our country to preserve our right to speak. You know, people in law enforcement, people in government, you know, have a duty to uphold that freedom. I mean, it's ultimately one of the most important freedoms that we have, perhaps maybe second to our freedom of religious expression and worship here in this country. You know, our country was founded by Christians 200 and some years ago, and the right to be able to freely worship was one of the reasons that our founding, generation, the Pilgrims and others, fled from England. So, you know, the right to preach, the right to speak, the right to share ideas, utterly essential to our country's future, to what we are as Americans, and we need to fight very hard to preserve that right.
Yeah, really well said. And I would say that free speech and free exercise of religion, I mean, go hand in hand, because you can't exercise your religion if you can't speak freely. And some in the Christian nationalist vein, and listeners know that, you know, I think that that is a false flag. It's dangerous. It's a term that is purposefully vague. It's not just saying that we are Americans that are Christians, and so we know that our sovereignty matters, and so therefore we're Christian nationalists. It's like saying Black Lives Matter. Yes, if you put, you know, all lowercase, we all agree that all lives matter and Black Lives Matter, but Black Lives Matter as the group, the organization, stands for something very different. So Christian nationalists, though, are attempting, in part, a lot of them want to bring back blasphemy laws. And it's interesting, the U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom defines blasphemy laws as punishing expressions or acts deemed blasphemous, defamatory of religions, or contemptuous of religion or religious symbols, figures, or feelings. And they want to make any, basically any criticism of Christianity outlawed in this country. And I could see that the left would use that for nefarious purposes.
Well, they'll say, well, you're doing it, so are we. Or if you can do it, so can we. And we certainly don't want that. I mean, you know, it bothers me when people, you know, disrespect God and use the name of Jesus Christ as a swear.
Absolutely.
You know, but it troubles me, but what it impels me to do or causes me to do is to pray for those people. Jesus doesn't want, he wants people to come to him freely. Right. Okay. We're not going to get into a doctrinal debate over free will, et cetera, here. But he wants.
Why not? You only have 5 minutes. You can do it.
Oh, we have 5 minutes? Oh, we can solve this problem in 5 minutes easily. No problem. but, you know, he said people will do this. And, you know, we have to preserve free speech because the gospel is based on truth and the truth will win. And so we need to allow all ideas and up to a point, right? Violence, advocating and inciting for violent action against people is a line. I think that's a reasonable line to draw. And that can get complicated sometimes. You know, if you got somebody posting something like, I'm going to kill this person, you know, or we should blow up mosques, you know, for example, which a person in the UK is being jailed for putting that online, right? So I think people need to be aware of their speech. But is that incitement? Oh, maybe not. Should it be criminalized? I don't know. We can have that discussion. But the point is that we need to have a very free space for us to discuss ideas so that we can engage people on the other side. And so when we talk about blasphemy laws, yes, it's very troubling that people would use the name of Christ and God in vain. That's against the Ten Commandments. But we've got to preserve freedom of speech so that we can freely preach the gospel, so that we can have opportunities to talk to people about these things, whether it's online or in protests or street preaching or just out on the sidewalk. And if we move down the road of controlling what people say and saying that you can't say this, you can't say that because we don't like it, we're going in the wrong direction.
Yeah, I agree. And even though I'm certainly not condoning the vulgarity that this UK man, which used a swear word toward Allah, the fact that he impugned that false god doesn't bother me. We should be able to talk about why Islam as a religion is false. I'm not really sure that that's necessarily what he was doing. He was protesting some other things. But the whole idea that more speech is always better so that we can have a free debate around ideas and we can all determine for ourselves the answers to life's most important questions of who are we? Is there a God? Who is God? And we can freely discuss those things has to be preserved. And I'm just really concerned with where the left is going into this extreme Marxist worldview. That worldview is trying to transform the rights of Americans that are centered in our pre-political rights that our founders understood come from God, not government, into so-called civil rights, which basically mean that whatever right they believe is paramount, like your sexual orientation, gender identity, then suddenly the cake baker, the website designer, loses their property rights and their inalienable rights. And that's where I think the conversation is headed, even to the Supreme Court. And I hope that the court and the majority on it continues to uphold our notions of freedom and the free exchange of ideas. So closing thoughts on that, Mike, and I really appreciate your views on all of this.
Well, I appreciate that, Jen. I couldn't agree more with what you just said, and we as Americans need to be prepared to defend that right. And I think we have a court that, you know, is more inclined to do so. So let's just keep praying and doing our civic duty. We have a choice to make coming up here in November. It's a pretty clear choice. And it's not just at the top of the ticket. There's a battle going on in the states. And honestly, you know, we've talked about this before, but I think the states need to step up and lead. And that's across the board on protecting speech, on protecting our freedom of religion and freedom of expression, and really pushing back against the federal government that's out of control and wants to curtail our rights. So I hope people are paying attention and looking at the choices they have for candidates in their local and state elections. Those are really, really important elections.
Absolutely. So well said. And as I've been continuing to hammer, we need to vote our values, and our central value needs to be truth. And the truth is that our rights come from God, our creator, and the sole purpose of a legitimate government should be to preserve and protect those rights. So vote for the candidates that are willing to do that. So Mike Donnelly, thanks so much. You can follow him on X at Donnelly Speaks, and we'll be right back with more here on Jenna Ellis.
A recent study reports that the rapidly declining global birth rate will lead to a major population crisis if birth rates continue to decline. Their massive support for Planned Parenthood is all part of their plan. While we may feel hopeless in the constant attack on life, there is an amazing way to fight back. When they shout abortion, we shout life. Preborn is leading the way. Every day, their network rescues 200 babies. When a mother meets her baby on ultrasound and hears the heartbeat, a baby's chance at life doubles. The ultrasound is the secret weapon that joins a mother's heart to her child. Preborn provides ultrasounds for clinics in the highest abortion areas. Can we join hands nationwide for life? One ultrasound is just $28, but any gift will help. $5,000 will underwrite ultrasounds for an entire network for a day. All gifts are tax deductible. To donate, dial #250 and say the keyword baby. That's #250 baby, or visit preborn.com/AFR. That's preborn.com/AFR.
Welcome back to Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
Welcome back. And we have been talking, as those of you who are regular listeners know, about the worldview differences between the left and the right, between Marxism and conservatism, between truth and falsity. And our worldview should be rooted in and based in the truth. And that should advise us on all of our policy positions and what we think in every area. And so when we talk about the difference between Kamala Harris and Donald Trump, we also need to talk about Kamala and Tim Walz's view on communism, because this is an economic theory that goes directly in the face of capitalism, of personal property, of the right to freely exchange property, have property rights. And I think that we use that term communism almost just like an insult, like perhaps the right does with, well, Trump is racist, and it just doesn't really mean anything. It's just a pejorative. And so so I want to bring on our next guest to talk about, you know, the two really stark differences in economic theory between the two candidates in the campaign, because this is a worldview difference. And so Tho Bishop joins us from the Mises Institute. And Tho, let's start there. I mean, from what we know, from what Tim Walz has said, that that it's neighborly to basically have this redistribution of wealth. He's basically saying that it's neighborly to be a communist.
Good morning, Janine. And yes, well, you've seen this kind of become increasingly mainstream within the Democratic Party. It's obviously been out there within the kind of the intellectual left for quite some time. But one of the things that's interesting is that kind of the true socialism, right, the kind of the Marxian ideal, is something that even the left, you know, even hardcore communists have in their own way, at least the more mature ones, have had to admit doesn't work in practice. There was one of the Soviet economists, Oskar Lange, many decades ago, even talked about how the critique of Ludwig von Mises, of which the Mises Institute is named after, which kind of goes after the if you have a truly socialist economy, if you truly have one state power that controls kind of the means of production, kind of the true Marxist way, that you don't have prices, you don't have the ability to kind of maintain an economy. And so that's what's led to kind of this broader, kind of more watered down view of wealth redistribution, of taxing the rich, of trying to take the capital stock that exists and try to redistribute it more equitably, right? That was a big theme of Kamala's campaign in 2020. And so I think that when we think about communism in its modern form, it's less kind of the pure economic original sort of Marxian idea, and something more spiritual, almost really kind of a destruction of the human spirit, a desire to remove sort of that individual free will in favor of the elevation of the state, and kind of that degradation of, I think, human dignity, really portrayed as, oh, well, we're just going to, you know, give you some better, we're going to take from your neighbors and give it to you, right? You know, it tries to use human envy as a means of perpetrating this aspect of it. But it makes kind of these conversations on, you know, what is modern day communism, I think, very, very interesting. And I don't think, you know, someone like Elon Musk is completely wrong when he says people like Kamala Harris or Tim Walz are communists. I think that's really what it looks like in practice in the modern world.
Right. And I don't think that that it's fair to only characterize them as socialists, because under socialism in a pure definition of that term, the citizens share equally in economic resources, but they're allocated by a democratically elected government, where communism, property and economic resources are owned and controlled by the state. And that's what Kamala Harris and Tim Walz are really standing for. So, I mean, while it may be like the AOC, well, democratic socialism, really it is a matter of the state coming in and controlling the property and the economic resources, and distributing them according to their own version of whatever they define as humanitarianism, rather than relying on the goodwill of the individuals to determine for ourselves, to take our own property and distribute it as we see fit, or use it as a tool as we see fit. And so do you think that it's fair to say that, you know, what they are driving toward under this economic theory, especially with what Tim Walz has articulated, really is more communist than it is just pure socialism?
Well, I think in many ways it kind of gives these people too much credit to suggest they really have any sort of economic theory per se. I don't think that many of the politicians, and to be honest, many left-wing economists even have kind of a true central theory by which they see the world. I think a lot of it has kind of been watered-down versions of, the works of John Maynard Keynes, of kind of these sort of politically opportunist, kind of ad hoc, like, oh, well, you know, we have an environmental crisis, therefore the state is the only means to solve it, so let's try to figure out rationalizations of increasing taxes on X, Y, and Z in order to do public projects, A, B, and C. And so I think more often than not, what guides public kind of the political agendas of the left, and to be fair, many Republicans as well, is less kind of a theory per se, a truly fleshed out sort of worldview, good or bad, but kind of this reflexive nature. But what you do have is this very, very, very dangerous aspect of playing up on the envy of different classes, a complete lack of appreciation for what is the processes within society that have created abundance, that has created the material well-being that allows for the civilization we have today. And I think that it's more of a mindset, I would argue, than it is kind of an economic theory. And what you have within that is a complete, a complete disinterest in what is it that has allowed for the massive sort of supply chains that we have. What is it that allows for kind of the industrialization and technology and things like that? And it's people that are essentially trying to kind of destroy the foundations, kind of the seed corn of modern civilization by pitching kind of just envy politics, by trying to do whatever they can to rationalize their way into whatever political agenda they think can give them more power. And because I think ultimately what these people care about is holding power. We've seen this with just the Kraven. I mean, a cartoonishly evil way that they've handled the Biden presidency in many, many different ways. And so it's everything is kind of rationalized through the perspective of what gives them power, what promotes their cultural and social views, and everything else kind of is back end into that. And I think that is a very, very dangerous, it's something that I think is, it cannot be defined by kind of pure economic theoretical terms, but it's instead something larger and perhaps even more darker than that.
I'm speaking with Tho Bishop from the Mises Institute, and I think the mindset, as you describe, is Marxism, because, you know, if they're focused so much on the collective good instead of individual rights, and of course the oppressor versus the oppressed, then people who are wealthy, other than themselves, of course, they always exempt themselves, but, you know, the people who are wealthy, who they would say tend to be, you know, the white male, and then there are the disfavored, minorities. And women who, you know, when they talk about women's wages and all of that, then they would say we need to have equality, and they're really talking about equity because everybody has to be the same regardless of merit. And so it really does, their communism and socialism is really predicated and grounded in a Marxist theory that negates the truth of personal property rights that come from God, our creator. And on the flip side, what we should be advocating for and what we should be well-versed in is an understanding of economic prosperity that doesn't have this this cap on wealth and redistributing wealth, that everyone has an opportunity to be wealthy in a society that has capitalist principles. Everybody can enter the free market, and there isn't this principle of scarcity of wealth of wealthy individuals, and capitalism promotes that. And so contrast, if you would, though, what the principles of capitalism are designed for human flourishing, where we're focused on the individual and everybody could be wealthy, but it's not a matter of redistribution of wealth where the state governs or this so-called collective good.
Well, capitalism focuses on giving property rights. It focuses on individual, as you mentioned, kind of individual achievement being, you know, the way that you serve your neighbor is itself measured by profit. You know, there is kind of the notion of sort of consumer sovereignty being what dictates the winners and losers in the market, ultimately how capital is allocated in the market. And of course, the problem is that we've had a complete distortion of all of these things within the modern world. Capitalism really does not exist in a world of easy money, of inflation. The government, we have the socialization of the dollar, for example, which has all sorts of consequences when it comes to market outcomes, things like that. And I'd argue on the other side of it is that we really don't have true Marxism today, because of the entire notion of a society divided purely on sort of economic class standards, right? The proletariat versus the bourgeoisie. I don't think Tim Walz or Kamala Harris necessarily believe that in kind of its current form, and clearly by the way that their lifestyles are. Bernie Sanders certainly doesn't believe it, as dictated by his own way that he lives his life. But what we have is kind of what Marxism evolved into. And someone just as important, if not more so, than Marx per se is Antonio Gramsci. We've got to recognize that in order for kind of Marxist ideals to be put in practice, what needed was something more than simply kind of this pure economic look at this proletariat versus bourgeoisie economic class sort of dynamic, and more this sort of class warfare, more the social warfare, the cultural warfare, the removal of Christ from society, kind of weaponizing these different, you know, the trans agenda, the gay agenda, kind of the more cultural aspects beyond the pure kind of materialistic aspect. I think ultimately, though, what is important to recognize is that, you know, this was true with Marx, this was true with all these sort of left-wing intellectuals, A lot of them were just kind of miserable people. And I don't mean that just as a purely sort of judgmental standpoint. I mean, Marx had like these really horrible boils, and he comes kind of just angry with the world. What really, I think, motivates a lot of the left-wing philosophers whose ideals end up being picked up through universities and end up influencing people who may not even be conscious of this. It's kind of this rage against the world at large, a rage against God, a rage against family, a rage against a lot of these pre-political aspects of society. And so what you get is you know, what begins, you know, what is taught as sort of this pure economic theory, you know, whether it's pure economic theory or you know, this sort of kind of sterile dogma within universities is itself fueled by emotion and fueled by other aspects, and this is simply creates sort of an easy rationalization for plundering people that you're jealous of. It feeds into this darker human, you know, psychology of envy, of greed, of lust, and whatever. And I that's where I think that a lot of economists, a lot of free market economists, for example, have gotten wrong is you know, they've kind of this pure focus on pros and cons, kind of materialistic arguments, kind of these kind of very narrow intellectual things. When what's really going on here is something I think larger than that. Ludwig von Mises wrote a very interesting book on the anti-capitalist mentality that kind of taps on this sort of psychological dynamic which fuels this sort of resentment of capitalism and free market systems. And I think in getting something that is deeper then kind of the pure intellectual game is something that's necessary to really understand what has given the left the power it has, and particularly the continuing political forms of these very failed theories that have done nothing but have brought devastation to every nation that has taken them seriously.
And I think that's a really fascinating observation, because if your worldview is not based in truth and understanding that all human beings are made in the image of God, have inherent dignity and worth, and have all of their rights that are pre-political, like property rights, then the antithesis of that, and where Marxism and all of these theories that end up being totally confused. I mean, you mentioned the hypocrisy of people like Bernie Sanders and Kamala Harris, who are all for redistribution of wealth, but I don't see Bernie Sanders redistributing any of his four houses, right? I don't see Kamala Harris just giving away tons of her wealth. So obviously there's that moment of clash between reality and the worldview that they purport, but any false worldview gets into all of the isms of whether it's racism, sexism, or categorizing and stratifying people based on something, whether it's race, gender, sexual orientation, wealth, status, you know, any of those things. If you don't have a worldview that is consistent in biblical truth, then you're going to categorize human beings on some other level. And so getting down to that philosophy and that worldview, I think you're absolutely right, though, is a prime motivating factor emotionally and worldview driven for these people. It's not just that they think the theory is better in good faith, it's that they genuinely have a false worldview. So we'll be right back with more here on Jenna Ellis in the Morning, and you can follow Tho Bishop as well on X.
Danny, the baby just rolled over for the first time. Oh, what a strong little boy.
That a boy, son. You're on your way.
Oh, aww, who's my strong little man?
Rollovers can be milestones in life, some early on and some later. One rollover you might consider is from your individual retirement account to a charitable gift annuity with the AFA Foundation. If you'd like to increase your retirement income and leave an impactful gift to the work of American Family Association, the charitable gift annuity is a worthwhile option. To learn more, contact the AFA Foundation at 800-326-4543, extension 345, or email foundation@afa.net. If you own an IRA, would like to increase your charitable giving, but need retirement income, the IRA to CGA rollover may be for you. Call the AFA Foundation at 800-326-4543, extension 345.
Welcome back to Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
Welcome back. And as we are talking about the worldview distinctions between the left and the right, and that this election comes down to a worldview difference, and you can vote for truth and freedom and prosperity or something else. And that's something else we need to define. So let's turn to foreign policy. What does that look like between a Kamala Harris administration versus a Donald Trump administration? Well, we had, you know, 4 years of Donald Trump. There were no new wars. I think that Putin legitimately was scared of what he might do. But then with the 4 years of Biden, we've seen the invasion of Ukraine by Russia. We've seen the war in the Middle East that is only escalating, with Iran threatening any moment to invade and attack Israel and be an additional aggressor. We are continuing to watch China, whether it invades Taiwan. I mean, there are a lot of different things going on. And the question in everybody's mind is World War III about to start? So what is the foreign policy difference between Kamala Harris and Donald Trump? So let's welcome in our next guest from the Mises Institute also, Zachary Yost. He's the co-host of Radio Rothbard and a freelance writer. So, Zach, give us your perspective on Kamala Harris and what we know from, I mean, she owns the Biden administration as well. It's the Biden-Harris administration. What do we know about her foreign policy and also Tim Walz when, you know, they're not answering any questions. They're not sitting down for interviews. They're just doing these rallies, but we at least have some record.
Right. Yeah. Harris is, in the same way she's sort of retracted all of her views from her previous run for president, she's sort of unclear exactly what she would do were she to become president, but I don't suspect it would be good. I don't believe that she will be able to extract the U.S. from the situation between Ukraine and Russia, whether that's by negotiating some sort of ceasefire or armistice, some sort of temporary end to the conflict at least. That, I think, is beyond her power. Similarly, the situation in the Middle East has exploded under the administration she's part of. I really don't expect that she'll be able to improve that situation much. And when it comes to Asia, the U.S., as of about a week ago, actually doesn't have any aircraft carrier groups in East Asia because the one that was there had to be transferred to the Middle East. So, I mean, she's part of, it's the Biden-Harris administration, and it's been a disaster. I don't see any reason to expect that disaster would be fixed were she to become president.
Yeah, I think that's a fair assessment that the disaster will only continue and possibly even get worse. And so, what does that do for the United States on a global stage as a world power if Kamala Harris were to get in office and have this kind of disastrous foreign policy?
Well, I don't think there's any doubt that it increases the risk of miscalculation, which could lead to a larger conflict that could pull the U.S. in. I mean, in general, people don't want war, even leaders of states, because it's dangerous, it's expensive, it's destabilizing. So sometimes wars just happen because actors miscalculate. And I think having someone like Harris, who's just not really on the top of the game, one might say, in charge, could lead to misperceptions by adversaries who could do something, and the U.S. could then respond in a way that adversary wasn't expecting, and it could just lead to wider conflict. I'm thinking here especially of Iran, potentially Russia. I don't think it's likely China would try and invade Taiwan, but it's possible they could ramp up the pressure. So I think it increases the odds for miscalculation, and that could lead to a very damaging, dangerous war.
And that is not an outcome I think that anyone wants to prefer. So let's contrast that between what we know of Donald Trump based on his record. He said very clearly at the GOP convention that he would solve the ongoing war in Ukraine. He would negotiate that peace deal. He told Hamas that they better return all of the hostages before he would take office. I mean, he is very pointedly addressed some of these global conflicts. And so, you know, what do we know or and can anticipate about his foreign policy strategy for America?
Right. So I think one point about Trump that, I mean, we'll have to see if it plays out, but in his first administration, he made some very poor personnel choices, where people were brought into the administration who completely opposed his goals. Listeners might recall that someone who worked in the White House wrote an anonymous op-ed in the New York Times literally saying, you know, we're working to undermine the president. So I think that hopefully, and he said things that make me think this is the case, he's learned his lesson there and will bring on personnel who are more aligned with his vision, which is more or less extracting the U.S. from all these conflicts, making Europe, you know, stop free riding, things like that. Putin explicitly said in an interview earlier this year that it was in Russia's interests for Biden to be reelected because Trump was less predictable. So I think that gives people pause as to gives adversaries pause as to, you know, oh, should we do this? You know, we're not exactly sure what happened. It promotes more caution. Whereas someone like Harris, I think, promotes, we can get away with this is more of a likely takeaway.
Well, and this difference, I think, in foreign policy really does need to be highlighted because so often, especially if we watch any of the mainstream media news, Zachary Yost, who's my guest from the Mises Institute, he's the co-host of Radio Rothbard, which is at Mises, and you can find that at Mises.org. when we talk so much about, you know, what's going on in the world, often not many segments or much attention is paid to foreign policy and what's going on in the world, unless America is directly engaged. Like, we may devote, you know, one segment to it, but America tends to be very egocentric. And so when there is this debate in September between Kamala Harris and Donald Trump, do you expect that foreign policy is going to be, you know, one of the bigger issues at that debate and even a voting issue for people? I mean, we know that the border, the economy, I mean, things here at home are definitely at the fore of voters' minds, but foreign policy does matter.
Yeah, I can't say whether it will be a big factor, but it definitely should be. I mean, the U.S. is basically waging a proxy war against Russia, which has the largest nuclear arsenal. That should be, you know, concerning. People in the military are waking up to the fact that were the U.S. to become engaged in an honest-to-goodness near-peer war, we'd have to bring back the draft, which will affect basically everyone. So I think the consequences of a disastrous foreign policy will affect everyone and every facet of life. So it really should be a focus of the debate, not to mention it just is one of the executive branch's sort of main functions. So it really should be a focus. And I think the approach and contrast between Trump and Harris will be very clear. So I think it's definitely in Trump's interest to steer the debate there, whether or not the hosts want it to.
Yeah, really well said. And for people who, you know, maybe are looking at this and saying, okay, you know, foreign policy is sort of a foreign topic to me, you know, no pun intended. What should people who want a good foreign policy for America be on the lookout for, and how should they understand that whole subject matter?
Right. So I think there's basically two clear approaches to foreign policy in America today. One is sort of the status quo. It's usually called primacy, the idea that America should run the world, that it is our job to basically protect everyone. And I mean, this led to Iraq, this led to Afghanistan, it's led to our involvement in Ukraine. And the contrasting approach is usually called realism and restraint. It's really a return to sort of the Monroe Doctrine. America is very secure and safe. It's not, no one on the planet could invade us or threaten our homeland, you know, unless we trigger a nuclear war or something like that. We should focus on our internal problems. We should stop allowing rich countries in Europe to free ride off of us. Basically, America should come home and stop trying to run the world, which has been a disaster for the past 20 years.
Yeah. Well, and the spread of democracy around the world, you know, that's been a debated question, you know, for a really long time. But, you know, this was from Rutherford. And in the last few minutes that we have with you, and I appreciate your insights, Zach Yost, there's another key issue, I think, in terms of just how we're allowing the encroachment of foreign invaders, not just through the border and our border policy, but also through the buying up of our agricultural land. This is from a Rutherford piece. It says, we're losing more and more of our land every year to corporations and foreign interests. Foreign ownership of U.S. agricultural land has increased by 66%. Since 2010. In 2021, it was reported that foreign investors owned approximately 40 million acres of U.S. agricultural land, which is more than the entire state of Iowa. By 2022, that number had grown to 43.4 million acres. The rate at which the U.S. farmland is being bought up by foreign interests grew by 2.2 million acres per year from 2015 to 2021. And the number of U.S. farm acres owned by foreign entities grew more than 8%, 3.4 million acres in 2022. I mean, this just seems like not a good idea to allow any foreign interest to own land, especially agricultural land, and basically start owning not only our real property, but our food supply.
Yeah, I think it's definitely an issue if some sort of Chinese Communist Party linked entity is buying up land next to a U.S. missile base out in the Great Plains. I think that's definitely an issue. I think part of it stems from people wanting to own assets outside of China because they don't want them expropriated. But I think that's an issue that we should be talking and debating about more rather than trying to run the world on the other side of the planet. We should be talking about those issues here. Cleaning your own room, as Jordan Peterson might say, taking care of our own responsibilities here. That's the discussion we're not really having because there's only, you know, limited time and resources, and we can't discuss everything.
Yeah, we're more concerned about, you know, commenting on what Jill Biden is wearing compared to Melania Trump. I mean, you know, things that just, and that's my eternal example, by the way, because I was once on a Newsmax hit where that was the topic. And I just thought, what a complete waste of time, because like, who cares? But, you know, but that's what, you know, a lot of the mainstream media networks on both the right and the left want to absorb the time, and is just purely entertainment instead of focusing on issues. And in just the last couple of minutes I have with you, I mean, how does this even happen that foreign interests can buy our land? I mean, you would think that Congress would make that illegal.
Foreign investment is considered good. Really, part of it stems from our expansionary monetary policy, really. Foreigners have lots of dollars, so they need to spend those dollars. And so why not buy, you know, investments in America? I think it sort of points to another issue with the primacist worldview. I mean, you can look going back to the 90s. There was this thought that, oh, if we, you know, we trade with China so much, they'll become, you know, a liberal democracy and everyone will be happy. And it'll be sunshine and rainbows. Well, that hasn't happened. You know, China owns trillions of dollars of U.S. debt. They have large reserves of dollars. It's basically empowered them. It's not made them our friend.
Well, and this is why, and Zacharias, thanks so much. You know, this is why worldview matters. This is why foreign policy matters, economic theory matters, and understanding the contrasting worldviews in this election absolutely matters. So we'll be talking about this more and more heading into November. You can always reach me and my team, Jenna at AFR.net. And I'm going to go make some more tea.
The views and opinions expressed in this broadcast may not necessarily reflect those of the American Family Association or American Family Radio.
We'd like to thank our sponsors, including Preborn. Preborn has rescued over 200,000 babies from abortion, and every day their network clinics rescue 200 babies' lives. Will you join Preborn in loving and supporting young moms in crisis? Save a life today. Go to preborn.com.